Well, Leonardo DiCaprio's new film, Inception, is just what we talk about on Coast to Coast. This has to do with an individual who hacks into people's dreams. Up next, Robert Moss, his latest work, The Secret History of Dreaming. He also has Dream Gates. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, he's back. Robert Moss, pioneer of active dreaming and original synthesis of shamanism and modern dream work. He was born in Australia. He survived three near-death experiences in childhood, and he first learned the ways of traditional dreaming people through his friendship with the Aborigines. Robert also hosts The Way of the Dreamer, which is a radio program that leads to a lively online dream school. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Robert, how are you?
Good to be with you, George.
I have a feeling our producer was dreaming of you because she just mentioned a few weeks ago, we've got to get him back on, and here you are.
Well, she has excellent taste and judgment. You hire good people.
Yeah, she is super. This movie, Inception, I think is going to be a blockbuster, and will get a lot of people interested in dreams, something that you've been looking at for a long, long time.
Right.
What do you think? You think it will?
Well, yes, I think it gives us some very good talking points. It's created a buzz about dreaming. The buzz is sometimes not terribly clear or helpful, I must add, but it has got people talking about the possibility of dreaming. It would be a shame if people thought that lucid dreaming, shared dreaming, active dreaming, all this good stuff is a prerogative of the dark side of the force to be done by corporate hackers on drugs and with funny machines. I mean, the truth of the matter, George, is that shared dreaming, a phrase they use in the movie, isn't ancient technique. It is typical of shamanic indigenous dreaming traditions, which I have studied. I've been teaching shared dreaming and group dreaming for positive and healing and helpful purposes for over 20 years now. And when I use that phrase, I don't mean Leonardo DiCaprio going inside someone's brain to construct a mind trap that is going to make them do strange things. I'm talking about people learning to embark on a conscious, intentional dream journey together, starting out lucid, staying hyper lucid, going to an agreed destination, going to a place of healing, solving something, and bringing back gifts. You see, that is the truth of shared dreaming. And the film enables us to talk about these things, but this is not, to put it mildly, what the film suggests. And frankly, you know, as a dreamer who is used to the fantastically colorful and interesting dreamscapes available to us, I was bored to death by these falling skyscrapers and this sterile sort of vertical icebox locale that they came up with. Hey, if we're going dreaming, can't we have a more interesting locale than those vertical iceboxes?
And, you know, we can use our dreams, as you know, Robert, to enhance your love life, to get a better job.
Yes.
It's a miraculous tool, isn't
exactly.
It?
Let me give you a quick example of a positive use of shared dreaming so we can put some light on this subject. A lot of people running around saying lucid dreaming this, lucid dreaming that, shared dreaming this, shared dreaming that. Let me give you a practical, simple account of how a couple in one of my workshops did shared dreaming together and produced fascinating results. Okay,
all right.
The guy's a senior executive in a corporation. He arrives with his wife, unusual to get a couple together in a dreaming workshop, but here they were, great. He's worried because he's dreamed that he is summoned for an emergency meeting at a house he does not recognize on the beach. He suspects, he does not know, he suspects that the strange house in the dream is his boss's second home on the beach. He's not sure. He knows in the dream that his job is on the line, he's probably about to be fired, and he's worried. So I say to him, George, his name is George too, I would love you to go back inside this dream consciously. He says, how am I going to do that? I say, I'm going to use this gee whiz piece of primal technology, a simple frame drum, a shaman's drum. I'm going to beat on it very steadily, and the drum is going to help you get back inside the dream so you can figure out what the heck is going on and what you need to do to save your job. And I say to him, George, I'd like you to take a partner with you in shared dreaming to go into the same dream space with you and get some practical results. He picks his wife. I'm not altogether thrilled that he's picked his wife, but I'm interested and I'm not going to stop them. So now I'm drumming and couples together in the workshop. Picture 30 or 40 people relaxed in easy chairs or cushions or on the floor, mm-hmm. Journeying together on this kind of assignment. This, George, gets back into the house on the beach. He goes through the whole house. He finds out what the problem is at the office, something going on behind closed doors he doesn't otherwise know about. His wife is there with him, George. They're together in a hyper-lucid dream, a shared dream, wide awake and conscious. When they come back from this journey, they talk as if they've been on a real estate tour. You know, he's a guy. He's looked at the deck. He's checked out aspects of the house, the den, the recreation room, things that appeal to the guy. She's better on the kitchen and the bathrooms, but between them, they could have designed the house. They've been there in that detail. The upshot is this, George. 6 months later, when the crisis that he dreamed about 6 months ahead of time erupts at the office, George has made the right moves to save his job. So he's sitting on the right side of the table when he's summoned to an emergency meeting at the boss's beach house. His job is safe. He's there, unfortunately, to rule on other people who'll be losing theirs. Oh. The second thing accomplished is, George, he doesn't need to ask where the restroom is because he's been there in his
country. He already knows.
See, this is the kind of thing that people need to know. This is experiential stuff. I'm a pragmatist. I'm not some new age mystic soap bubble guy. I'm a guy who comes from a very practical tradition. That is the ancient Paleolithic tradition. I'm a Stone Age guy, not a new age guy. I come from those dreamers who know that this stuff can save your job and save your life, and that going into shared dreaming isn't about dark side corporate stuff and Pentagon plots. They might be going on. I'm not saying that they're not going
right,
on.
Right.
But I'm saying that there's a human, practical, life-supporting aspect to all of this, which unfortunately Hollywood directors have not yet been smart enough to give us on the movies.
Now, you, way before you became a dream teacher, Robert, you have been a history professor, or a correspondent, a foreign correspondent, an editor for a magazine, a best-selling novelist. How did you get interested in this?
Well, this is my life story. This is where I come from. I mean, I can hear I talk funny. I'm a boy from the bush. I grew up in Australia. The native people of my native country, the Aborigines, they say, George, that your personal dreams can take you into the dream time. That the dream time is not to be confused with the personal subconscious that psychologists are always telling us about. The dream time is the real world. It's the place which is at the origin of the events and situations that come about in our lives. It's the place where you meet the wise teachers and the ancestors who can show you what really matters. So the Aboriginal understanding is that through dreams, not just through sleep dreams, but through wide awake dreams and through listening to signs and synchronicities in the world around you, you can get into the dream time. So by osmosis, that's part of my upbringing. But what made it clear to me as a kid that all of this was extremely important was that I died a lot. You know, in those days, we didn't have Raymond Moody's term, the near-death experience. You know, that sounds sort of kind of respectable, but I rather prefer what an Australian doctor said when I was 9 years old to my parents. He said, "Oh, the poor kid, he died and he came back, didn't he?" I lost vital signs for several minutes in a Melbourne hospital when I was 9 years old. I went in for an emergency appendectomy. I'd been in the previous week for double pneumonia. I was a very sick kid at that time. And when they were starting to operate on me, I had an experience which you've heard about from other people, and this part of it is not unusual. I found myself floating up under the ceiling, looking at the scene of a 9-year-old kid with blood and scalpels and nurses talking and not wanting to be there. And I wander out of the operating theater, George, and I wander down the corridor, and there's my mother sobbing, and I don't want to share her pain. I know how worried she is. I want to do what regular kids want to do. I want to go to the beach. I want to go to the theme park, you know, down the beach. Luna Park just for fun. So I find myself, without thinking about what's going on, going through the window, going down the beach. I've forgotten I've left my body in the operating room. There's the big moon face entrance of Luna Park, the Australian theme park. And I go through the entrance thing. I look at the girls. I ride on the trains. I go on the rides. I don't have to pay for a ticket. And suddenly there's traction, and I'm not exactly on the ghost train that I've boarded. I'm sucked down into the earth. And, George, I'm welcomed by people who are humanoid, but not quite like us. They're very elegant, they're very thin, they're very tall, they're very pale, they're beautiful, they welcome me as one of their own. And I seem to spend the life of a man for maybe 90 years among them. I become a father, a grandfather, an elder of their society. Then my body is used up, and they cremate me, and I float up on the smoke, and I think I'm going to their afterlife, but I'm drawn back into the body of a sickly 9-year-old boy on an operating theater in Australia, and I remember this. And I remember this. Jeez. And it's very hard to talk about this kind of thing to the adults around me in a conservative era in Australian society. And I'm an army brat. I'm from a military family. You didn't talk about this kind of thing recklessly.
Right.
And the first person I met who understood this kind of thing that I could safely talk to was an Aboriginal kid who said, "Oh, yeah? Matter of fact, you see, not mystical. Oh, yeah, we do that. We get sick, we go to a special place with the Mimi spirits, and when we get well, we come back. That was the first explanation I received of what had happened to me. But you see, George, if you've had this kind of experience in childhood, there's been no safe way of talking to about it to your teachers or your parents or your family, you learn to lay low for a while. So I was quiet about the dreaming for a long time in my life, but I used it. It kept me alive when I was a war correspondent in Vietnam. I would be dead on a road outside Phnom Penh if I hadn't listened to a dream. The photographer I had a date with that morning is dead because he wouldn't hear the dream, but I did. So in all of my roles in life, as journalist, as professor, as a thriller writer, as teacher today, I have used the dreaming, but I reached a point in my life when it became essential because of my own visionary experiences to go public and help people to claim the gifts of the dreaming that are waiting for them. It's time. We need this. It's of the most urgent and vital importance that we become dreamers again in the full sense of the word. Our planet needs it. Our humanity needs it.
It's critical.
It's critical. One of the things that dreamers do in indigenous societies, George, is, again, so far beyond Western psychology, they listen to the earth. They listen to the earth. They listen to the sea. They read the patterns of the larger picture. They feel and intuit the cycles of life over the larger perspective. They hear the ancestors and they communicate with those who are not yet born. They guide the incoming souls into the body so they can be born well in this world and have spiritual parents. They do things like that. A little bit idealistic, but practical. We can learn to do this too, and my goodness, it's time.
Robert, tell us the story of your moving to upstate New York and what happened there.
All right. Well, it's the story of a red-tailed hawk and an oak tree. And I'll tell it quickly. I had got fed up with cities. I'd been on the commercial fast track. I was making lots of money. Everybody wanted my autograph. Every major TV show in the world wanted me. I'd written thrillers that were on the New York Times bestseller list, and I was bored to heck. You know, my creative self wanted to do something else. My dreams were telling me it was time to do something else. So I'd heard about an area on the upper Hudson River Valley of New York on the edge of what used to be Mohawk Indian country, and I found in a synchronistic way, you know, I live by synchronicity, in a synchronistic and unlikely way, I found this rundown farmhouse on a lot of land, and I thought, okay, this could be good, but I know nothing about this area. I've got no friends up here. If it's the right place to move to learn the land in my adopted country, there should be a sign. Now, at this moment, I'm sitting under an old white oak tree behind the farmhouse, and a red-tailed hawk comes circling overhead, squalling at me in a voice I feel I should be able to understand, but at the time I did not speak hawk. And she, I learned later, it must have been a female because of the larger size, she drops a wing feather between my legs. This feels awfully significant. It wasn't the only reason I bought the farm, but it was a big one. Living on that farm, I found myself one night rising from my body out of the bed, spontaneous out-of-the-body experience, and traveling, not disembodied, but traveling on what seemed to be the wings of a red-tailed hawk, scaled to my size. And it was delightful. I've never met anybody who does not enjoy the experience of flying in this way,
right?
Astral flight. I'm flying. It's very physical. I'm wide awake and conscious, by the way. Let's give up the delusion that dreams are all about sleep. They're about waking up. So I'm wide awake and conscious, and I'm traveling out of my body, and I'm traveling north over a primal landscape where there are no highways and no developments. And I'm fascinated by catching thermals and seeing things at different angles. And I tilt and I come down and I feel some discomfort as my wing feathers brush the dried up needles of a spruce tree. And then I feel a firm intention summoning me. I don't have to go, but I choose to follow a will that is reaching to me. And I find myself in a cabin in the woods near what today would be Montreal, but there's no sign of Montreal. And there's a native woman, beautiful, faced like a wrinkled apple, who is speaking to me like lake water lapping, cadenced language, wave over wave. And I don't understand a darn thing of what she's saying, but it seems significant. This was my first encounter with an Arondiwano, a woman of power, originally Huron, but adopted by the Mohawks after her early capture, who became the mother of the wolf clan of the Mohawk Nation in the early 18th century. And she became a friend and guide and interlocutor of mine, and I developed the opinion over time that she was one of those great shamans who can reach into the future seeking information for the survival of her people. And my encounters with this native woman, who I call Island Woman in my books, changed my life. I mean, other things were going on. My father died, and that led to some very deep and profound experiences at the same time. But they changed my life. They made me know that I had to do with dreams and with healing what this traditional people did, which is to help people look in dreams for the secret wishes of the soul and help them find what the soul wants in life and not just what the ego wants, what other people's expectations are. This, for me, George, is what dreaming is fundamentally about. It's looking for soul. It's listening for soul. It's finding where the soul has been broken or bruised or lost because of life's challenges and compromises and pains and abuses. It's about getting the soul back and using dreams to find us where the soul wants to go. That applies to both the living and the dead. And the encounters with this Iroquoian grandmother, this Rondiwano, of the Kanyekahaga, the Mohawk people, I had to learn some of their language to understand these dreams, by the way, so I speak some Mohawk, gave me the courage and the clarity not to become an ersatz Mohawk. I'm not a Mohawk Indian. I'm an Australian and a man of the West who feels in tune with all spiritual traditions all over the planet. But this kicked me alive to things that our ancestors all understood, which in our modern state of cultural soul loss, we have forgotten. So I've given my life to a cause, George. I want to help midwife a dreaming society in our time, in our world. It is time.
Good for you. Good for you. You call a lot of your work active dreaming. What is that?
Well, I've been using this word for a very long time, and actually the book that I'm writing at the moment will be called Active Dreaming. For some reason, I didn't put it on a book until now, but now I'm going to. The phrase initially when I came up was a bit of a provocation. You know, we think dreams are passive experience. You lie down, you go to sleep, and a dream comes upon you. Well, yeah, big dreams come like that. Big dreams do come upon us. I'm not knocking that. That can be very important. We get visitations in our dreams, and they can change everything. But we can learn to be active dreamers in a couple of important senses. First of all, we can learn to go actively into the dreaming. We've got all this kerfuffle about lucid dreaming these days. It actually started not with Inception, with the New York Times saying you'd have sex with anybody you like in a lucid dream. Since then, people have been talking about lucid dreaming all over. There's a far more interesting concept, and I'm going to use the word active dreaming to describe it. It's this. You want to have a conscious or lucid dream experience to do something really interesting? Start out conscious and stay conscious. All this business about looking at your hands and so on or having blinking goggles is marginal. You can start out conscious. You can learn to shift consciousness, go into the dream state actively, do it with other people if you like, do it with a whole group. We routinely do it with 30 or 40 people in my workshops. We travel together in conscious dreaming. How do you do that? You set yourself an agenda. You set yourself a really interesting assignment, and you go for it. You give yourself a fuel and focus for the journey. We use shamanic drumming in the workshops, but at home you can use other methods. So that's the first sense of active dreaming. You learn to go consciously into the dream state and do something really interesting with it. Healing, adventure, excitement, fun. You can learn to go back inside any dream you like that has some juice for you and go on with it. Step beyond the terror, resolve something, get information, save your job, as in the story I told. The second big sense in which I use the word active dreaming is this. We want to get active about dreams and dreaming in our world, in our society. We want to learn how to talk about this with each other, make a safe space for it, learn to give each other non-authoritarian feedback so we are supporting each other instead of taking each other's power away, and above all, help each other come up with action plans, plans that can make life better, plans that can embody energy and guidance from dreams so we all do better. And we want to learn to grow a community vision. Again, goodness, it's time. We need to dream together as people, as human beings, on how to put things right on this planet and how to bring into balance our relationship with everything animate around us. So it's about being active with dreaming in two senses, being active about going into the dream space consciously and having conscious adventures there, and being active with dreams of life as well as dreams of the night in the world every day in every environment.
So we don't have to go to bed just to do this.
Yes. This is fundamental. Here's my personal mantra about this, George. Dreaming is not fundamentally about sleep. It's fundamentally about waking up.
Yes, you are
about
so
waking
right.
up. In waking life, we're often like sleepwalkers. When we go dreaming, we wake up. Native peoples don't confuse dreaming with sleep experiences. You don't have to go to sleep in order to dream. As a matter of fact, if you learn to pay attention to chance encounters, coincidences, the symbolic pop-ups in the world around you, you find that the world all around you can speak to you like a dream, and that's how I navigate all the time. I'm looking for patterns all around me, not in the sense of conspiracy theory or some nutty paranoid version. I'm just interested in the way that the world will speak like a dream, like a forest of living symbols, to quote the French poet Baudelaire. The world is a forest of living symbols that are looking at you if you will make some space and pay attention.
Robert, we're going to come back with you in just a moment. We'll get into more about dreams. I want to get your take on definitions, and then wait till you hear the secret history of dreaming. We're going to take your phone calls next hour with Robert Moss as we talk about the secret history of dreaming. And it's time now for our traditional shout-out. Those of you listening to Coast on your favorite radio stations across North America, hello to you, and thank you for all you do. Streamlink members, soon to be Coast Insiders, and then XM Satellite 165. The various chat rooms and groups, NighthawkZone.com, folks. Good to have your server up and running finally. Imaginative Worlds, Into Infinity, the National Radio Club, Sorcery IRC, the Twitter group, the Facebook groups, MySpace groups, Yahoo Chat, Northern Kentucky Paranormal Group, the Hollywood Ghost Hunters, SoCal UFO Meetup Group, hello to you, and Above Top Secret, and old Greg in St. Louis. Thanks for keeping Coast to Coast the number one rated show at night in the world. And I should say Robert's incredible website, Moss, M-O-S-S, dreams.com. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. Robert, I want to get into in a moment the secret history of dreaming and some of these incredible stories here. But dreams in general, some people remember them, some people don't. I've always heard that we always dream all the time. What is your belief?
Well, there are people whose dream function is impaired, and they're in serious difficulty, George. I mean, very serious alcoholics, for example, may actually, I mean, I like a drink or two, so I'm not knocking the booze, not saying you have to give up
your favorite beverage. A little glass of Merlot is pretty good once in a while.
Yeah, I'm not saying that you have to give up your favorite beverage, but serious alcoholics sometimes succeed in impairing the dream function, so they may actually be dreaming less. But we shouldn't confuse the dream function with dream recall. I mean, the evidence from the people who monitor the brain waves in labs and so on is that we all dream for a certain amount of time every night. There's been a long and now somewhat tedious dispute over whether it's just REM state sleep when your eyes are moving behind your eyelids, or whether we are dreaming or mentating, an ugly word they use, all the time. I'm of the opinion that we're dreaming or thinking or drifting in some way all the time during these hours of sleep. And it's not just hours of sleep. Let me again expand our understanding of what we're talking about. You get all this stuff about sleep dreams. People in our society, including the so-called dream and sleep research experts, don't talk nearly enough about hypnagogia. That's the $5 word for those liminal states, those dozy states in between sleep and waking, in between waking and sleep. The French have an old word for this that I'd love to bring into the English language. The word is dorveille, which literally means sleep-wake. You're in between wake and sleep. That is a very creative space. Where in my secret history of dreaming, and I'm not anticipating the discussion about that, but let me just say that when I studied for that book where solutions were made, where scientific breakthroughs were made, where creative breakthroughs were made across history in every field, I found that that state, that liminal state, you're not quite awake, you're not quite asleep, is decisive. So when we're talking about night experiences, let's not forget it's not just sleep versus waking.
Right.
It's that liminal border state that is absolutely critical that we've got to pay attention to. Now, let's talk about, and by the way, it's often easier to recall things from that state than from sleep, because when you wake from sleep, particularly if you're rushed out into the world by the alarm clock or the kids or something, it's like a big sort of bank vault door swinging shut and closing it off. It's hard to bring it back. Even I have mornings like that, big lifelong dreamer that I am. I'll have mornings when I don't remember anything, then it comes back under the shower when I'm wandering around. So, I mean, a very simple practical question is, you know, how do you start improving your dream recall? And I will talk about sleep dreams for a moment, because I'm in favor of sleep dreams, George. It's spontaneous sleep dreams. We don't want them. We don't ask for them, but they can hold up a magic mirror to our actions, our behaviors. And here's something fundamental. Our dreams are scouting out the future for us. We prepare. We rehearse.
On their own, they're doing that?
My opinion is that we get ahead of ourselves in our dreams in a way that can be interesting. When I track my own dreams, I want to know, where did my dream self go last night? How far into the future did he go? Who did he visit? And do I want to go where he went? And by the way, this is a very indigenous way of looking at dreams. We get around in our dreams. That's indigenous understanding. Dreaming is social. We visit other people. We visit other worlds. We travel across time. And one of the things to know is we travel into the future all the time. This is the indigenous understanding. Western psychology largely ignores it. Jung was very aware of it, for example, but he's very embarrassed about talking about it and really could never get himself to talk simply and clearly about the fact of precognition. Once we wake up to the fact that we travel into the future in our dreams and can see the future to a greater or lesser extent, though it might be hard to understand what we're seeing, we can then wake up to something far more interesting than precognition. The far more interesting thing is this: if we can see the future, we might be able to change the future for the better. And our dreams might be a better source of information on the possible future than lots of other sources around us. So, you know, if we're not recalling our dreams, we're missing out on the movies, we're missing out on entertainment, we're missing out on adventure, we're also missing out on life-supporting information that we really need to do better.
Some people, though, in their sleeping dream state, have incredible nightmares, don't they?
Well, I'm going to be very provocative. I'm kind of in favor of nightmares. Let me explain.
Please, yeah.
Let me explain. A nightmare, in my definition, is not just a scary dream. You can have a scary dream which you're shredded by a saber-toothed tiger, but you come out feeling fine. That is not a nightmare. That is a scary dream. You got through it. A nightmare is an experience in the night that is so scary you ran away from it because you couldn't take it anymore. That is a nightmare. It's an aborted dream, an interrupted dream. And it is very bad policy to run away from your dreams. I'm in favor of this experience in this sense. It wakes us up to the fact we have to pay attention to something beyond the understanding of a little everyday mind. Once we have an experience like that, we need to understand we've got to get to the bottom of this. We've got to understand what is going on. That might require us to go back inside the dream by the active dreaming technique I teach called dream reentry. Go back inside the dream, face the fear, and see what happens. Let me give you an example, which also brings in the idea of shared dreaming. And I hope that someone from Hollywood is listening, because Hollywood needs to make a movie that brings in this kind of stuff about shared dreaming. Let me tell you a story quickly about getting beyond a nightmare. So a woman artist I know, obviously I won't identify, but she's quite a well-known artist, is terrified because in her dreams, recurringly, there is a jumping spider that is getting bigger and bigger, and it's in her studio, and she can't work in her dreams, and she's terrified, and now it's getting huge. She tries to kill it. She cannot, and she consults me. We are sitting in her house outside the door of her studio. I say, okay, great dream, I say cheerfully. I want you to step right back inside it, face the spider, and see what needs to be done. She's not cheerful about this suggestion. She's shaking like a leaf. She's sobbing. I say, I will come with you. I'll come with you. I'll be your friend and bodyguard. I will do nothing unless I have to, but I will come into your dream space with you. This is real shared dreaming, George. This is the real thing, not the Hollywood celluloid dark side crap. This is the real thing. I will come with you into your dream. I will help you face the spider and see what needs to be done. So I'm holding her hand. It doesn't take a great act of imagination for her to put herself back inside her studio, face the spider. The spider grows until anatomically correct, until it is bigger than she is, and I am with her. I'm holding her hand. We are together inside her studio in our dream bodies, where our physical bodies are sitting outside. She is frightened, but she holds her ground, and eventually, after what seems like a very long time, a huge, terrifying spider, now bigger than human size, becomes a beautiful, radiant woman, a version of Spider Woman, a Native American form of a goddess, who says to the dreamer, because you found your courage, I give you the power to reweave the energy web of your body so you do not have to get cancer again, and I give you the ability to reweave the web of your life so you will enter the greatest creative period of your life. When she went in for the biopsy that had been scheduled, she was cancer-free, and she has entered the most creative period of her life.
Remarkable.
That's an example of how a nightmare, if we will accept it as an alert to wake up and do something, can be a gift. It's not a gift that we just go on trying to shut the door and sit on top of the door and say it's only a dream. That is foolish policy. We do that, the issue in the nightmare will come and get us in waking life. It's as simple as that.
That is truly remarkable, how your body, how your mind triggers this kind of mechanism to teach you, to warn you.
Exactly. Here's another of my personal mantras about dreams. I make these things up. I mean, I'm a writer, as you know, so are you. And I like making up one-liners. So one of my personal one-liners about dreams is, dreams are not on our case, they're on our side. For exactly the reason you just gave.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. Absolutely true. Let's get into the secret history of dreaming. We're going to get into calls with you next hour. I can't believe how fast these hours are going by, Robert.
You're a dream host. It's just such fun talking with you.
It is remarkable, some of these great stories. I'll just throw out a few, and you can fill in the middle. You talked about how in dreaming, What happened to Sam Clemens, who became, of course, Mark Twain?
Well, so let's see, the book is called The Secret History of Dreaming. It is really a history of what we tend to look at three things: dreams, coincidence, and imagination. From my point of view, they're a seamless web. Mark Twain is a guy who dreamed a lot. He was a very accurate precognitive dreamer. He lived a parallel life in his dreams. The girl he fell in love with on the riverboat, he dreamed of her to the end of his life and lived a parallel life with her in his dreams. But the funniest stories about Mark Twain, it's very hard not to tell a funny story about Mark Twain, despite the deep river of sadness and tragedy in his personal life. The great stories about Mark Twain are about how he lived by coincidence. And as I say repeatedly, tracking coincidence is the dreamer's way of operating 24/7. And by the way, for anybody listening, if you're not in touch with your sleep dreams, hey, pay attention to the waking symbols and synchronicities around you. Any given day, you get something, and maybe that'll kick your dream life awake. Anyway, so here's a story of how, told in my book, The Secret History of Dreaming, thank you for mentioning it, of how Mark Twain became Mark Twain. He was originally Sam Clemens. He's got a job in a print shop up in Iowa, and he finds a book about Brazil. He's never heard of Brazil, but the book says that they have some wonder plant down in Brazil which can fix your ailments, and he thinks he's going to make a fortune by getting a local pharmacist to finance a trip to Brazil to get this wonder plant, which is called coca. Nobody's ever heard of coca at this time in the 19th century.
And it's legal then, right?
Well, they've never heard of it. They don't know what it is.
Yeah,
they
okay.
Can't discuss whether it's legal or not. I guess Coca-Cola came along later and was using it. So anyway, but let's stay with the period. So here's young Sam Clemens. He gets on the riverboats and goes down, eventually down the Mississippi to New Orleans, and nobody can tell him how to get to Brazil from New Orleans. I mean, it's a bummer. So now he's wondering what to do, and he strikes up an acquaintance with a colorful Mississippi riverboat captain and pilot called Horace Bixby, and he somehow persuades Bixby to take him on as an apprentice riverboat pilot, which is a pretty good meal ticket in these days. So now Sam Clemens is on the river, and he's hearing the boatman's cry, Mark Twain, meaning safe waters, and he's getting the material for his novels, his beloved Mississippi Tales. So the snapper, as Mark Twain would say, the one-liner out of this experience, relevant to all of our lives, is this. Because Sam Clemens could not find Brazil, he failed to become the first cocaine dealer in North American history, and he became Mark Twain, beloved author. That is an example of some of the rules of living by coincidence or synchronicity, which I wrote about in another book called The Three Only Things. For every setback, look for the opportunity. You can't get to Brazil, so what else is going on? And also, you know, in order to get found, we may have to get lost. We may have to lose our way in order to find our way. And the chapter on Mark Twain and the Secret History of Dreaming is, I think, a remarkable case history of what it is like to live by coincidence. His life turned on coincidence such a degree. And you know what? This wasn't just random. Mark Twain studied coincidence. He made it his game to magnetize coincidence and draw interesting opportunities and people to him. So if you study that part of Mark Twain's story, you can see how you could become a synchronicity magnet and actually, beyond the silly new age law of attraction thing, actually help to bring magnetically the events and opportunities you want into your life.
And Robert, see, I don't believe in coincidences. I believe in fate doing things.
Okay.
And you've used the word synchronicity many times tonight. I believe in that.
Yes. Well, see, Mr. Jung invented the term synchronicity because he's fed up with people saying, not understanding how to talk about coincidence. I actually like the term coincidence, but it's probably a losing battle to try and restore it to our vocabulary. Synchronicity literally just means things happening at the same time, and coincidence is more interesting than that. Synchronicity or coincidence can run in a riff. You know, something happens one day, and then 3 days later, something resembles it, and you feel the things are playing out over time. I had a dream once in which Einstein, I'm not claiming this is the spirit of Einstein, my dream character Einstein appears to me, complete with staged German accent, and he shows me something that looks like a great contraption in a theme park, you know, with spokes and things coming out at all sorts of angles, spinning up and down and roundabout, tilt-a-whirl kind of deal. And he shows me that at the end of these spokes are things that he calls probability bundles, and he's trying to explain to me how synchronicity really works. He's showing me that in a given throw, certain objects contained together in one bundle, and the word quantum means bundle, by the way, will be thrown across time and space, and they will manifest in the world of three-dimensional reality in different times and places, but they all originated from one single movement in a reality beyond our world. Now, that simplistic sort of funfair image is my best way of understanding what is really at work in synchronicity. And I'll say this to you. It is through the study of synchronicity, in my opinion, that we are most likely to understand the true relationship between mind and matter, personal and transpersonal, three-dimensional reality, and the multiverse, the multidimensional universe of which we are part. So we want to do this not only to get messages and games to play in everyday life, but to begin to get a better grip on what reality is actually all about. Synchronicity is when the forces of a deeper world come pushing or poking through the curtains of our consensual hallucinations to bring us awake.
You have a great story about the dream expert Sigmund Freud.
Oh, yes.
And how he didn't even look at his own dream.
Yes, I mean, this is a tragic story. And I have some admiration for Freud. Obviously, I'm not a Freudian, but Freud made a huge contribution at a time when most psychiatrists were just physiologists looking at things as physical phenomena. Yeah. And he was a literary man who read literature and used it. But Freud tragically missed what was probably an advisory of the mouth cancer that killed him. And it was in the most famous dream that he analyzed, the centerpiece of his famous book, The Interpretation of Dreams, his analysis of the dream of a patient he calls Irma. And in the dream, he's looking in her mouth, and she has strange discolorations and other things going on and what looks like a prosthesis at the bottom. And he doesn't sort of pause to say, could the patient in my dream be an aspect of myself? Well, 30 plus years later, he developed symptoms very close to those of the patient he's examining, like a dentist or an oral surgeon in his dream, the same pattern of discolorations. He dies with a horrible prosthesis in his lower jaw, which basically makes it impossible for him to eat or to swallow with comfort. And the question to be raised when you compare Freud's medical records with the details of the dream is, did his dream give him what some would call a disease marker? In other words, was the first cell of the cancer in its early stage speaking to him, or was it a precognitive dream of what killed him? Either way, and this information, by the way, has been ignored almost completely by the entire psychological community, not just by the Freudians, but just about everybody else. It took a little-known Argentine psychiatrist, Freudian psychiatrist, who is also a cancer specialist, to compare the records of Freud's treatment with the dream and come up with this information. And as far as I know, it hasn't really been discussed in any accessible source in English, except in my book, The Secret History of Dreaming. So the sad conclusion is, for anybody who thinks that Freud is an authority on dreams, the dream doctor couldn't miss the dream diagnosis that could have saved his life.
Yeah,
terrible story.
Absolutely.
Terrible story.
Yeah, so, you know, sometimes you just don't see what's right under your nose.
Well, that's right. And I mean, and to be fair, in fairness, I mean, I or anybody else may miss something that's right under our noses, which is one of the ways that we need to train and teach people to help each other bring out the meaning of these things in a way that is safe and helpful. And that's one of the things I do as a teacher. I teach people to talk about these things in a much more liberated and helpful way than we've been accustomed to doing.
Where can people get The Secret History of Dreaming, Robert?
Should be in any bookstore. You can get it from the online booksellers, and I think you've got a link. I don't know whether you've got it up on your site, but you can certainly, if you follow the link to my BeliefNet blog site, you'll see the cover right there.
Absolutely.
One of my 7 books on active dreaming, by the way.
You enjoy this.
Oh, I love it. I mean, it's my passion. I was asked the other day at a car rental desk in an airport, business or pleasure, and I looked at him and I said, I don't make that distinction in my life. And actually, the guy had a sense of humor. He cocked his head and said, are you a writer? I said, well, that's pretty good. How'd you get that? He said, I was trying to think of somebody who would not divide business from pleasure in his life. And I think that one of the tricks of life, and you've probably accomplished it too, George, is to do what you love and let the world support it. And that's the way I live.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And between us, Robert, we do it for free.
Wow. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I can say this in all candor. It makes absolutely no difference what money I earn from anything that I do. I do it all because I love it.
Yeah, it does. I want to talk with you about why you believe dreaming should be essential to our survival. We'll talk about that next hour, and we'll open up the phone lines. We'll give you an opportunity to talk with Robert Moss. It's been a couple of years since he's been on the program, and that's way too long for me. I'm glad he's back. We'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. His website, again, mossdreams.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Our website, of course, you can also get to it by going to georgenori.com now. So we'll be right back.